Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jordan Factor, bar number 38126, and I represent Australia Unlimited. When determining whether a contractual provision is ambiguous on a motion to dismiss, this court reviews the contract in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. When viewing the release provision in the light most favorable to Australia Unlimited, it is at the very least ambiguous. Certainly, it does not unambiguously reserve Crop's right to sue Australia Unlimited for future sales of the accused products. Given the strong public interest in the finality of patent litigation settlements, release provisions are construed as general releases unless the release language expressly reserves future claims. Thus, the burden is on the patent holder to expressly reserve the right to sue for future acts of infringement. It was not Australia Unlimited's obligation to demand that the release provision expressly release future claims. It was Crop's obligation to expressly reserve the right to sue Australia Unlimited for future sales of the accused products, which it failed to do. The release provision does not reserve Crop's right to sue Australia Unlimited for future sales of the accused products.
Counsel, so it's your position that unless the release says in exactly so many words, we expressly reserve the right to sue for future conduct, that is released for all time?
That is correct. And it,
and is there case law to support that?
Yes, Augustine, that is the holding of Augustine. It was followed at least by the district.
Well, but Augustine had very futuristic language in it. May have, I forget the other words, but there were two or three phrases that were looking to the future. Words which don't appear to be in this release, which has, as you know, an effective date clause.
Three responses, Your Honor. First, Augustine does have the phrase may have, which we contend is no more future oriented than language in this release provision, such as forever discharge. Secondly, the Augustine court did not rely on the futuristic connotation of the may have language in reaching its holding. Its holding was that the burden was on the patent holder to have reserved its claims. And that's what the District of Massachusetts and other courts concluded was the holding of Augustine. And third, Augustine did have an effective date clause, as does the current contract. And the court in Augustine concluded that mere reference to claims arising prior to the effective date is an inadequate statement to effectively reserve a patent holder's right.
Can you hold on just a moment, counsel? Can we please turn on the clock?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
I appreciate the court's indulgence.
And hopefully you'll also appreciate, you know, us taking maybe 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes off your time, if that's okay.
Of course, Your Honor.
Thank
Absolutely.
You. Okay, hold on 1 second, counsel. That's perfect. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so the burden was on Crops to expressly reserve the right to bring claims in the future, and it failed to do so. Therefore, Crops misses the mark when it argues that the release provision does not expressly release claims. It's the seminal argument is that Crops failed to reserve the claims. However, Crops' interpretation is incorrect. What Crops contends is that because the release contains the phrase brought or could have brought, it only released those claims that it brought or could have brought in the underlying litigation. And because patent infringement is a continuing tort and each sale gives rise to an independent cause of action, it could not have brought claims implicating future sales in the prior litigation. That is incorrect as a matter of fact and as a matter of law. As a matter of fact, Crofts did bring claims implicating future sales in the prior litigation. It sought and obtained a TRO, restraining Australia Unlimited from making future sales of the accused products. It sought to convert that TRO into a permanent injunction and then released that claim as part of this settlement agreement, in which it also stipulated to entry of dismissal with prejudice of its claim for injunctive relief. Therefore, to the extent the release provision releases claims that Crofts brought, it brought claims implicating future sales. However, Crofts is also incorrect as a matter of law. The court in Augustine rejected this very same argument about the salience of patent infringement as a continuing tort to whether a patent holder can bring future infringement claims. And what the court in Augustine held is, if a patent holder knows at the time of settlement that a defendant has a particular product, and it fails to expressly reserve the right to bring claims for future sales of that product, then that product is subject to the release.
Counsel, please help me understand, what was the consideration that Australia gave then in this agreement, the settlement agreement? What did Crofts get?
Australia Unlimited had counterclaimed for invalidation of the Crofts patents. The parties were getting close to trial, and Crofts faced a very real and imminent threat that Australia Unlimited would succeed, that Crofts patents would be invalidated, and that the market would be flooded with competitors. And in order to avoid that, Crofts decided to settle with Australia Unlimited.
But okay, so it got that, but didn't it get something saying that you couldn't sell competing products, at least for some period of time?
No, there's nothing in the agreement to that effect. To the contrary, Crofts actually agreed to not disparage Australia Unlimited's products or make inaccurate representations of its own products, contemplating that the parties would immediately begin competing. Moreover, the final sentence of the release provision says, notwithstanding the foregoing, products of Australia Unlimited that have not been sold in commercial quantities are not released.
That's right. So products that have not been sold in commercial quantities are not released. So products that are sold afterwards in commercial quantities
are released. That's the way I read it as well.
Are released. That is the correct.
No. I was going to say nothing releases or discharges products that have not been commercially. So if they have not been sold as of the effective date, they have not been released.
Right. So Crofts asserted a claim based on a design patent, asserting that the accused products looked and felt too similar to Crofts products, and therefore the accused products themselves are released from claims that it violates the design patent. However, products of Australia Unlimited that Crofts may be unaware of are not subject to that release.
Where does it say that in the release agreement? Part of the problem that I had with counsel, it's usually a red flag for me when someone has a brief where they talk about what the contract language is without putting the exact contract language in their brief. Just as a matter of candor toward the tribunal, that's something that should happen.
I agree.
But I now have a copy of the contract, so point me to the exact language that you're talking about.
And Your Honor, we do cite the exact language of the contract in our opening brief.
With a lot of ellipses, counsel.
I don't recall exactly how we cited, Your Honor,
okay.
But I would refer, Your Honor, to our statement of facts, where I believe we cite the entire release provision without ellipses.
Okay.
And what it
if that's
said,
the case, counsel, I apologize.
Okay. And what it says in the final sentence is that products of Crofts that have not been sold in commercial quantities are not released. However, the accused products, which indisputably were sold in commercial quantities,
you're right,
are released.
In commercial quantities before the effective date.
That is correct.
They're released, but those that are sold after that are not released.
But we're talking about the type of products, Your Honor. We're talking, the accused products is a defined term and is contained within the release, referring to three types of designs of Australia Unlimited: the diamond design, the marquee design, and the closed top design. Those products, those designs are released. Other designs, which would be other products that have not been sold in commercial quantities, are not released.
It says any products. It doesn't say other products.
Any products that have not been sold in commercial quantities, but the accused products were products that were sold in commercial quantities. However, Your Honor, all of this, once again, assumes that it was Australia Unlimited's obligation to get an express release of future claims for sales of its products, and that's not the case. Crofts needed to expressly reserve its right to bring claims related to the accused products, and it failed to do so. And therefore, reversal and remand is warranted, and I would reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel, if we are coming up on the red light for you and you need another 30 or 40 seconds in light of our timing malfunction earlier, I'll be glad to grant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jared Bryant, attorney registration number 35773, and I represent the appellee in this case, Crofts, Inc. This declaratory judgment action represents AU's attempt to transform a backward-looking release into an affirmative, forward-looking patent license that AU now wants to sell back to Crofts or some other party. The trial court in this matter correctly found that the party's standard backward-looking mutual releases was unambiguous as a matter of law, and the plain language of that release should be enforced. AU's present attempt to create an affirmative patent license where none existed in this settlement agreement fails for three reasons, and I'm going to discuss each. First, it contradicts the plain and ordinary language of the release. Second, AU cannot create ambiguity in this release by relying on extrinsic evidence. Third, and under the plain and ordinary language of this release, claims for post-settlement infringement as a matter of law do not arise out of pre-settlement facts. So let's start with AU's interpretation of this release and the fact that it violates the plain and ordinary language. The analysis of this settlement agreement is no different than the analysis of any other contract under Colorado law. The starting point is the plain and ordinary language. So let's look at what it says. And the settlement agreement is, the release provision of the settlement agreement is quoted in full at page 5 of Crofts' answer brief, and also appears in the record across pages 2 and 3. It's in paragraph 6A of the agreement.
And it is, in fact, in the opening brief, and I apologize to counsel about that.
And if you start at the beginning of the release, it first releases claims, and it uses a lot of other synonyms for claims: causes of action, demands, etc. But it releases claims. Then the next limitation is its claims that arise out of or occur as a result of facts, acts, events, or omissions that happened before the effective date. So right after the release of claims, there's a clear limitation that those claims must arise out of facts that occur before the effective date. Then the release goes on to use a word of focus that not only must the claims arise out of pre-effective date facts, those facts must also pertain to claims that Crofts brought or could have brought in the underlying case. And that's it. That is the broadest scope of the release.
What about the claim that they brought the injunctive relief claim for future-looking acts?
Your Honor, the TRO that counsel for AU mentioned was actually grounded in a prior contract. This, it had nothing to do with a patent claim. And actually, interestingly enough, this case below was not originally a patent case. This case involves claims both ways for breach of contract, for fraud, for trade dress violations, and then only later were patent claims added to the case. So it's a little bit confusing why AU is trying to read in a forward-looking patent license without addressing the fact that there are a number of other claims in the case.
And there was no seeking of injunctive relief for patent infringement in the case after it was removed to federal court?
The Crocs did have a request in its complaint for injunctive relief, but that doesn't matter because Crocs isn't required in an underlying case to assume whether AU is going to continue to manufacture these products or estimate what the level of sales are going to be. And actually, the Federal Circuit in the Aspects Eyewear case, I think that's one of the cases that was cited in both parties' briefs, actually addressed all the reasons why the fact that a party might seek an injunction in an underlying case is not relevant based on a number of reasons kind of pertinent to patent law. But then getting back to the release, we got to the pertaining to claims brought or could have brought. Everything else is a further limitation. The very next word in that release is including without limitation. That the balance of that sentence is basically a non-exhaustive identification of the types of claims that could arise out of a pre-settlement fact. And then counsel for AU also referenced the very last sentence in this release. And I think this is one where it's really important to focus on the plain language. First off, it starts with notwithstanding the foregoing. So notwithstanding the foregoing, and for purposes of clarity, nothing herein releases or discharges any products of AU that have not been commercially sold in non-sample quantities as of the effective date. What this additional limitation is an additional carve-out of the release of pre-settlement acts. And what it covers are unknown, unsold products. And if you were to adopt AU's interpretation that somehow the implication of this releases designs, which is not even found in this sentence, for forever in the future, then basically everything else I just read in this release needs to be read right out of the release. That language, the clear limitation of arising out of facts occurring before the effective date has no meaning if you adopt AU's interpretation.
All right, so help us understand what this not commercially sold in non-sample quantities is all about.
Sure. Well, for example, in a patent case, an act of infringement is not a product. It's a make, a use, a sell, or an offer to sell, a product that's covered by a patent. So you can infringe a patent a number of ways. You can infringe it solely by selling a product. You can infringe it by making a product. You can infringe it by importing a product. And what this gets at is Crocs' concern that when it's releasing claims it could have brought, so claims it may not even have known about before the effective date, it's concerned about what if AU had made a product, what if it had used it, but never actually sold that product? What if Crocs never had the opportunity to discover the basis of that claim? It was fine releasing claims that it did not know of so long as they arose out of pre-settlement facts. But that's, for purposes of clarity, that's one exception to that rule. So that's an additional limitation on the release of a pre-settlement fact.
So tell us how that would work out in the real world. So let's say that Australia had some of these shoes that they had manufactured but not yet sold as of the date of the release. What is this telling us about those products?
Yeah, I think what this gets at is if they have a design or if they have a shoe that is manufactured and sitting in a warehouse, but it's not been sold and Crocs has no opportunity to know that it had been sold, then that is not released. So that actually operates as an additional limitation on the broad release of claims arising from facts occurring before the effective date. And I also want to look at specifically, I think just as important as what the release says is what it doesn't say. Nowhere in this release is there a reference to a design of AU shoes. Nowhere in this release is there a reference to a license, to a patent, to trade dress, to breach a contract, to do anything. Nowhere in this agreement are any restrictions or terms of use of such a purported license. And most importantly, and this gets back to the Augustine case that AU cited in its opening statement, the release does not include the terms claims that could be brought by Crocs, i.e. future-looking claims that were at issue in the Augustine release, or it also doesn't release claims quote-unquote, relating to pre-settlement actions. It's more limited than that. It's more focused on claims arising out of pre-settlement facts. And in fact, those were the two dispositive facts in the Augustine case. And I know counsel for AU was focused on the general policy of placing the burden on the patentee to reserve claims. Well, sure, that makes complete sense under the facts of Augustine. If you're writing a release that releases claims that you may have sometime in the future, I agree. You should probably have the burden to carve something out of that future release. But that's not what the parties did here. Here, they agreed to a very specific, explicit release of claims that arise out of pre-effective date facts. That's a backward-looking release. It happens in cases all the time, standard in litigation. And in fact, not only would adopting AU's interpretation, not only would it require the court to read out that explicit limitation of the release, which violates Colorado contract interpretation law, it would also undercut the party's ability in future cases to craft and rely on these standard backward-looking releases, especially in a case like this where there's numerous claims. This is not just a patent case.
When you say this is a standard backward-looking cases, do you have any other cases that have the very same type of clause in it that has been held to be a standard backward-looking provision?
Well, I think there are definitely cases cited in our brief. Specifically, the one that jumps out at me is the SV case from the Middle District.
That has this very clause in it.
It actually has more expansive language than this. It actually has the clause in SV is claims that were asserted, so just like ours, and then that are relating to, so it actually includes some of that Augustine expansive language, pre-settlement actions, and the SV court still found that that did not bar a potential future claim for infringement. And that's also consistent, I think it's actually very consistent with the Augustine case. Augustine focused on this future-looking word. They focused on claims that Augustine may have. And here in our release, all we have are claims that were brought or could have been brought. It does not say claims that could be brought. And so our position is that this language of the release is unambiguous on its face. Now, I want to address AU's allegation that it is ambiguous. And I just want to say that AU cannot create an ambiguity through extrinsic evidence. Its wish that this release contained a future-looking patent license doesn't in and of itself create ambiguity. The law here is well established. Ambiguity only exists where a contract term is reasonably susceptible to more than one meaning. And that's just not the case with this release. A differing interpretation alone doesn't create ambiguity. Silence alone doesn't create ambiguity. And when determining whether a phrase is ambiguous, you just cannot consider the party's own expressions of intent. So in other words, anything that AU said leading up to the agreement or after the agreement is not part of the analysis. What you can consider, aside from the plain and ordinary language of the release, is the circumstances surrounding the making of the contract. And this settlement agreement could not be clearer. On the very first page of the settlement agreement, page one in the record, the very last whereas clause, it speaks to this. It says, Crocs and AU now wish to compromise claims and counterclaims in the present action. It does not say that they're resolving or compromising any potential future claims, solely on the terms and conditions set forth in this agreement. It doesn't speak in any way to claims that may be brought in the future. It doesn't speak in any way to future claims of any kind. So it's the circumstances of the agreement, in fact, support the plain and ordinary language of this release.
So, counsel, would you say that even if we were to accept Mr. Factor's rule that you have to have an express reservation, are you saying that that actually has been done in this case?
Your Honor, I think we would argue that the explicit limitation, limiting claims that are released to those arising out of pre-settlement, pre-effective date facts, is an explicit limitation. And again, to contrast Augustine, the parties in that release went beyond that to go ahead and release claims that may be brought. And I agree, when you're in that situation, if you want to carve something out, then you should probably write that in your release. But given this explicit limitation, there's no reason to carve that out. And so finally, I just want to touch on what the effect of the plain language of the release is. Under the plain language of this release, claims for post-settlement and patent infringement cannot, as a matter of law, arise out of pre-settlement facts. That's consistent with the Patent Act. The Patent Act says that a make, use, sell, and offer for sale, each of those standing alone is an act of infringement. And the Federal Circuit has been very clear that patent infringement is a continuing tort. So if there were a hypothetical new case, that case would not have to allege any pre-settlement facts. It would just need to allege that there was a sale that happened at some point after the effective date of a product that was covered by a patent. And that's it. It's consistent with the plain language of the release. Crocs could not have brought such a future claim at the time of this settlement agreement because the tortious conduct in question had not occurred. It's consistent with cases that are cited in our brief that allow claims for this future infringement brought after resolution and dismissal of a prior infringement claim. And the two I'll point your attention to are the Cordes case as well as the Williams case. Both of those cases involved an initial broadly worded patent infringement claim, a settlement and dismissal with prejudice, and then a subsequent infringement claim on the same product, with the difference being that the sales alleged to be infringed occurred after the settlement agreement. And in both of those cases, the claim was allowed to proceed. And then finally, Australian Limited raises a number of claim preclusion cases in its briefing. And I just want to touch on that for a minute. Claim preclusion is somewhere you don't have to go here. It doesn't change the analysis. First off, it's not even a proper circumstance to raise a claim preclusion argument because there's not been a second case. The first element of claim preclusion is the same claim. Well, all the cases where that arises, there is actually a second case. That's not why we're here today. Secondly, claim preclusion is not a basis to interpret a contract. There's no basis in Colorado law to rely on federal claim preclusion cases when you're interpreting the plain and ordinary meaning of a contract. And so this court does not need to decide any claim preclusion issues here. So accordingly, because the language of the release and the settlement agreement is unambiguous, it should be enforced according to its terms, and the trial court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Counsel, do you want 40 more seconds?
I'm okay, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And do we have any time left on appellant? Yes, we do. That's what happens when you get old. You forget these things. Sorry.
Well, then I'm getting old, I guess.
No, I get it. I know.
Thank you, Your Honor. Crocs contends that because the release has this language that it releases claims arising out of or occurring as a result of facts, and here are my words, that transpired prior to the effective date, ellipses, involving the accused products, that therefore this cannot possibly be a forward-looking release, and to the contrary, it's actually an express reservation of future claims. Augustine rejected that very same argument and held that mere reference to claims arising prior to an effective date does not constitute such an express reservation. However, once again, Crocs is incorrect as a matter of fact, because any claim for future sale of the accused product would necessarily arise out of facts involving the accused product that transpired prior to the effective date, specifically the design, manufacture, marketing, and sale of those same products. Again, we're dealing with a claim for infringement of a design patent. The same product that would be sold after the effective date is the product that was designed prior to the effective date, and the allegation is that its design is too similar to the Crocs design.
Isn't each sale another patent infringement?
Yes, each sale does give rise to an independent cause of action. However, again, Augustine concluded that that is not enough to constitute an express reservation of the right to bring future claims, number one. And number two, even if Crocs could prove infringement without reference to facts predating the settlement agreement, which we do not concede, nevertheless, that is not the standard for interpreting this contract between the parties. This contract between the parties said, to the extent any future claim arises out of any facts, and it uses the phrase any facts, involving the accused products, they are released.
Notwithstanding, for purposes of clarity, products sold after the effective date will not be released.
That's exactly right.
Products sold after the effective date are not released. It's a continuing patent infringement. There's no release of it. You could be subject to liability.
No, Your Honor, because accused product refers to a particular kind of design, not a given shoe.
It says any products in the last, any products. It doesn't say any except for the accused products.
That is correct. Any products that have not been sold in commercial quantities. The question is, what does product mean there? Does it mean a pair of shoes sitting on a shelf, or does it mean a product line, a kind of design? The way that the settlement agreement defines accused products is by reference to certain product lines, certain types of design. So when it says any products, it means any designs, any product lines, other than the product lines that constitute the accused products. Now,
that seems to be an exception that's not in the language. It doesn't say other than the accused products. It says any products.
It says any products not sold in commercial quantities. The accused products were indisputably sold in commercial quantities.
Before the effective date.
Absolutely.
And so any products sold after the effective date, any products, are not released.
No, Your Honor. That is what the settlement agreement in the preceding sentence clearly says, that Crocs is releasing claims respecting enforcement of the patents in suit involving the accused products. Okay, then it says, but we're not releasing claims against products that were not sold in commercial quantities. That is a contrast to the accused products, especially when viewed in the light most favorable to Australia Unlimited. Now, Crocs' interpretation will not hold up under discovery, but this case needs to be remanded for that. Thank you.
Perfect timing. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, both counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted. The opinion will issue in due course.